Welcome to the Voices in Japan podcast with Ben and Burke. On today's episode, we talk about Carlos Ghosn's escape from Japan. Mr. Ghosn used to be a very popular figure in Japan, especially in the early 2000s, for helping turn around the business of Nissan. In November of 2018, Mr. Ghosn was suddenly arrested upon landing in Japan, and charges were eventually brought against him for alleged financial misconduct. He claims that he has fled the injustice of the Japanese legal system and has been trying to shift the attention to what has been reported in overseas media as a plot by other executives at Nissan and the Japanese government to prevent an irreversible merger between Renault and Nissan. The Japanese legal system has started to receive a lot of scrutiny as a result of this situation, and we talk about that on this episode. We recorded this episode on Skype, and we're going to actually put that video up on our YouTube channel, Voices in Japan. So if you'd like to see the video of us recording this episode and also check out our ugly mugs, then please visit our YouTube channel. We've also put up a new website, voicesinjapan.com, so if you have some time, please go and check that out. Thank you for supporting the show, and now on to the episode.
1, 2, 3.
How you been, man?
Been all right, man. Just obviously.
You ever be a cold?
Well, it's not really a cold. It was a flu, obviously. So yeah.
Yeah.
Had the flu.
Your voice sounds a little bit, I don't know, croaky.
but that might be. I don't know if that's from the flu or because I had to go out last night. Yeah, so I'm actually
whiskey voice.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, see, the thing is, so I might be coughing a little bit during this because, I still have the residuals of the flu, but B, yeah, I mean, I'm not coughing because of this, but I have people visiting. It's been a really busy start to the year, but I have some people visiting, so I had to go out with them last night. I didn't stay out too late or anything, but. But yeah, it's been a pretty crazy start to the year. Had the flu. Have you ever had the flu before?
Maybe a long time ago. But I mean, I thought I had the flu, but I think it was just man flu. So I was just being a wuss. I just like stayed in bed for like 2 days and then it was gone. So I don't think it was flu. I think I just had a cold.
You know what they say? Actually, I mean, I read about it a little bit because I had it, but they said that like, they did this study where they injected people with the flu virus just to see what would happen. And like half of the people showed severe flu symptoms. And like a portion of the people though showed zero symptoms at all. So it's like sometimes even when people catch the flu, the way their body responds to it can be completely different. Like my wife thinks she's never caught the flu before, but now maybe she has caught it. I've realized and she just doesn't show symptoms. Well, no, she doesn't have it right now, I'm saying, but she, you know, she's probably caught it in the past up to this point, but she just never showed symptoms before. Like some people just don't show the symptoms of the virus.
What strain did you have?
I had A, type A. So, yeah, like.
Which is pretty harsh, right, that one?
Yeah. Like what happened is came back from the U.S. Man, had a really good trip to the U.S. over the break. Talk a little bit about that later, but came back and then I got hit with jet lag really hard. So I was waking up like. Every night, after just like 2 or 3 hours of sleep, so my body was just exhausted, and then I started to get like cold symptoms. But normally, when I catch a cold, like I have a runny nose or something for like I don't know 5 days, but like the runny nose went away like in 1 day, and went straight to like started coughing, and then also the next day like I got a high fever of like 38 or something, and so I went to the hospital to get it checked out. Because it went up to 39 degrees the next day. And I'm like sitting there at the hospital. I'm like, I think I have the flu. I need to get this checked out. And they're like, okay, can you wait? And I had to wait for like 30 minutes. And I'm like sitting there like in pain, suffering. And then they're like, okay, you can see the doctor now. And I went in and I saw the doctor. And I'm like, I think this is the flu. And he's like, all right, let me check your throat. And he's like, okay, it might be the flu. We'll give you the flu test. Go sit outside. And then I had to like sit outside again for like 20 minutes. So I was almost at the hospital for like an hour before they actually did the flu test.
Oh my God.
And then it came back like 30 minutes later, and they were like, yeah, it's the flu. But yeah, so it was pretty bad, man. I had like all the symptoms, like high fever for like 4 or 5 days. I threw up a couple times, had upset stomach, and then, yeah, severe cough. So it's been a pretty miserable
man,
time.
That sounds bad. When did you get better? Like a couple of days ago?
Yeah, like the fever finally went away like 3 days ago. So I went back to work. And but I'm still coughing, and my wife's parents actually caught the flu, and they said that they, like, that was like 2 weeks ago when they caught it, and they're still coughing a little bit. So I think this year's flu virus is pretty severe, they were saying. But
and you, yeah. You had the flu shot, right? You were telling me.
Yeah, I got the flu shot. It was completely a waste of money, man. I mean, like, it's required in our company. And, yeah, that was the thing of the company. At first, they were like, didn't you get the flu shot? They were kind of, like, doubting that I actually got it. But we have to turn in our receipt to the company to show that we got it. And we actually get a little bit of money back from the company. They support, like, the cost of the shot. But, yeah, so I did get the shot, and then everyone's like, yeah. But that's the thing, like, even if you get the shot, it may or may not build up an immunity, but also, like, it might just reduce the severity of the symptoms. So people are like, oh, you should be happy that you got the shot because it wasn't that bad. I was like, dude, it was bad, man. So.
So yeah, how's your new year, man? How's back home? Had a good
yeah,
time.
Man, that was good. Like, that was kind of short, flew by. Our family met up in San Diego, and been to California before a few times, lived there for a while actually, but never been to San Diego. That was pretty fun. Like, we went to the safari one day, which was good because not really too big on zoos, but at least the San Diego safari area is like a huge, huge open area for most of the animals. We went to the beach a couple days. Like, it was kind of cold, but it was warm enough to get in the water a bit and warm enough for the kids to play on the beach. Went to restaurants and stuff. Went to a small amusement park, Beaumont Park it's called, and stuff. But, man, it was good to see family. First time for my kid to see some of her relatives and cousins and stuff. So everyone was excited about that, and we did, like, the big countdown and stuff. But you were in Japan for New Year's, right?
Yeah. I just did the usual... You know, sitting in front of TV, drinking a lot, eating a lot, watched the Rising fights, which were pretty disappointing this year, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just the refereeing was really bad, some bad stoppages, and not really any big names. I think the best fights were the female fights. They were a bit more scrappy.
Saying that last year too. You kind of always like those female fights.
Yeah, I think they just choose like a couple of hot girls and then they just go at it. So it's a bit more entertaining, even though the skill level is usually quite low. But yeah, apart from that, went snowboarding on the 2nd, January 2nd. That was awesome, man. I went to Rizutsu. That was like, waist thigh deep powder. So they had about a meter of snowfall within a week, and me and my mate, we got like the end of that. So it was almost one of those times when there's too much snow, but luckily it wasn't, like, it was kind of fast enough so we wouldn't get stuck. But that was pretty much my new year. Pretty slow. Like, there's no countdown in Japan. It's just as soon as the chimes hit, they just ring the bell right in the shrine. So we had that on TV and then ate some soba, the traditional soba, and that was it, man. Yeah, it was nice and relaxing. The kind of way I like it these days. Getting old, I guess.
Have you been out a lot this year? Like, I finally brought back. I think it's actually back there in the corner. I brought my board back, new board and everything.
Right. Yeah. Is that it there?
Yeah, it's in the bag there. But I mean, it's actually still in the plastic, you know. I've been sick, you know. I got sick and then just busy, and it's almost already coming up to the end of January now, so, and I still haven't even been out once this year, haven't had a chance to get on the new board yet, so got to get out there for sure. But but the conditions are good?
No, I don't think you're missing much. I really don't. Like, the day I went was, we were lucky, but ever since then, the snow's kind of slowed down, but I think it's going to come in February. You know, we're in kind of mid-January now, but February will probably be the time it will start really dumping down. So yeah, I think you got another month and a half maybe. So February, March is when it will really come. But it's been a really bad season for snow this year. I went to snowboarding last weekend, actually, last Saturday. I went to one of the local mountains, and normally they have like a lot more snow than the other resorts, but even they were needing more snow, so you couldn't really go off course. There was a lot of, you know, holes where there was, you know, grass and dirt. You could see that.
Really?
Some creeks. You could still see some creeks, whereas normally by now all that's covered up and you can just like plow through that. So yeah, I didn't do any off course riding at that place.
Wow.
So yeah, you're right, mate. You don't have to, you're not missing too much. So
yeah, but unfortunately, like, these people, you know, I was out with last night, they're visiting. I knew some other people that are visiting over the new year while I was in the US and stuff. And I mean, everybody comes to Hokkaido for the legendary snow and the powder, but yeah, most of the people have been coming. I mean, they've been saying it's good because I think it's still better than places in the U.S. and whatnot. But I just feel bad because they haven't really seen like what Hokkaido can be like. And I hope it does get like it normally is, like next month. And I hope this isn't like the beginning of like a stretch of years where it's going to just continue to get worse or something, you know?
Yeah, because last year was pretty bad too. It's worse this year, but last year was not so great either. Like it came late. It did come in the end, but also, you know, end of January, beginning of February. How long are your friends here for?
They were here for a week, so they're actually leaving today. But I got another group of friends coming in beginning of February, so hopefully they'll be here right at the perfect time for the snow.
Are you a fan of global travel? Are you wanting to see more of the world yourself? Well, then you're my kind of people. My name is DeAndre Koch, and I'm the host of the travel podcast, Revolutionizing Your Journey, where we share stories of everyday people making the most of global travel and also teach you how to do the same yourself. You'll hear stories from people just like you who learned how to travel for nearly free, like Jo, who realized she could take her daughter to Disneyland in Tokyo for cheaper than in the US, or Rob, who flew his entire family of seven to Europe round trip in business class, all for less than the price of economy. Check out the link in the description for the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast to learn how to elevate your own travels.
Nice. And then you can get your board out of the plastic wrapping.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully I'll get out before then, but we'll see what happens, man. Yeah, man, the new year is getting off started, man. I'm pretty bad that I got sick to start it off because, like, I was like, man, new year, new decade, like, kind of, it's going to be like the year of no BS for me, man. Yeah, I'm planning to make some big changes, like, you know, because I was thinking about it. Yeah, well, you know, like, people who come to Japan and they study Japanese and they try to get to become part of the culture, for me, I was like, kind of like method acting approach a little bit. I was like, I'm going to just kind of be as Japanese as possible and see if that like helps me understand like the language and the culture better, you know? And then like, I think that just kind of kept building. And like over the past year, I've just been thinking about things. And I'm like, man, I'm not really the same person like I was. I think when I'm out with friends and stuff, I am, but just kind of in Japanese culture or when I'm out in society, I think I'm still pretty reserved because I'm trying to like, you know, be as Japanese as possible at certain times, you know? And I'm like, I'm just not going to do that anymore, man. No more BS, man. Just going to be like who normally am and everything.
Just be straightforward.
Yeah, and just like,
holding back.
Yeah, like, don't even worry about trying to be Japanese and upsetting the Wa, man. If the Wa gets upset, let it get upset, you know? Like,
yeah,
I'm not going to do it anymore, yeah.
Have you started doing that?
Nope. No, actually, a little bit I have.
Use resolution.
Yeah, but I mean, actually, I have a little bit. And yeah, there's going to be some big changes coming up. I think can't talk about right now, but that's all going to be part of it as well, man. Yeah, like new things getting going. New things that we're trying to do with the podcast like this.
Yeah.
The Skype is our first time doing it. I think it's going to take a little bit of time for us to get used to it.
Yeah, put onto YouTube. Hopefully, spread the word about our podcast. Got a new website, everyone. VoicesInJapan.com.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, check that one out. That went live in January sometime. I had some good comments, some good feedback about the website, actually. They really liked that photo that's on the website that our friend Matt took. Yeah, very artistic. So anyone wants some photography, yeah, hit up Matt Holloway. Yep.
Yeah, that was good on you, man. You've put that together so far, the way it looks and everything. And I think we can expand, put some other pages on there to help share some more things that people might want to see. But, yeah, I also got to say, man, thanks to you and thanks to Yumi for stepping up.
Oh, last great week's episode?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she came through for that.
Our first explicit episode. Man, it was a bit of a pain trying to get the E tag, explicit tag.
Yeah.
So I was going back and forth, just trying to get it up there. But it finally got there in the end.
Oh, is it? Is it there now? Okay. I saw the communications you were having with the people there trying to get that up there and stuff. So it's good that finally got figured out. Yeah, the first explicit episode. So yeah, there'll be some other things that hopefully we'll be putting out there this year over the next month or two. So we're a little bit late to talking about today's episode just because we were going to talk about it earlier.
This is the first time I've seen you this year, I think. So it's a happy new year.
Yeah, happy new year to you too. And it's a happy new year to you too. And we're not actually seeing each other. It's in Skype. But yeah, I was thinking about that too. And actually, this is the first time for us to record in quite a while too.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Just because been away. Yeah. You've been sick. Yeah. Oh, well. Yeah. We got there, though. We got there in the end.
Yeah. And jump back into it, man. We had a full year last year, 40-something episodes or something, nonstop. So that was a good year, I think. First a maiden year. Definitely. Were able to go through.
Yeah, it was good fun as well, recording.
So should we just bring this up here, this today's topic?
Yeah, let's get into it. Gon? It's all about Gon, right? Or is it Gon? How do you pronounce his name? I used to call him Gossen.
Yeah, I'm hearing more people say Gon now. But so big news, Gon. Actually, when I was in the U.S., the news came out that he had escaped, as he put it. Escaped injustice. He's had a few pretty interesting quotes to this whole thing. Of course, is one that he's been saying the most is that he did not. What did he say? I have not fled justice. I have escaped injustice and political persecution. So he's been putting out a couple of interesting quotes there. But yeah, when I was in the U.S., the news came out that he all of a sudden showed up in Lebanon, and everyone was like, "What? You're not in Japan anymore?"
Yeah.
So he kind of took off and everything. So, yeah, we can talk about a bunch of stuff, the background and everything. But let me ask you, man, when was the first time you remember hearing about Carlos Gon? Was it
the very first time?
Yeah.
Probably about a year ago when he first kind of got arrested for the first time. And that made, pretty big news. That was, front headline news of most of the newspapers. But I didn't really look into it back then. I just heard he got arrested for hiding certain data or personal financial information. He was not exactly stealing money from the company, but he was accused of hiding, his true salary and compensation. So that was why he was arrested. That's what I knew. And then I kind of stopped following after that.
Before this whole thing started, though, I mean, you had obviously heard about him because he was a bit of a legend in Japan. I think the first time I heard about him was, because I came to Japan in 2002, and I was teaching at that language school, and one of the teachers walked in one day with this book that was written by Carlos Gon, and she's just like, "Oh, you gotta read this book, you gotta read this book." And I looked at the book, and it was Japanese cover, and there's a picture of Mr. Gon. I was like, man, the only thing I understand about what's on that is a picture of that dude, Mr. Gon. But yeah, that was in 2002, and that was when he was at the height of his fame and popularity, because he had come in and turned around Nissan, and that was at that point he was putting out books about management. I think that was also the same time when they were putting out anime and manga about Mr. Gon.
Wow.
He had reached that legend status, yeah, and everyone was saying, "Oh, he's a genius," you know. And
I'll be honest, I didn't know much about going before a year ago. Like, yeah, I don't really follow Japanese business so much, so I guess that's why I didn't really hear about it much. And I don't know, my students weren't very interested in kind of stuff like that. Yeah, and even my friends didn't really talk about going until now, actually. Yeah, is the most I've heard about him, like, through friends and articles, you know, friends posting stuff on social media. But before a year ago, yeah, I didn't know anything about him pretty much.
I wasn't too interested. I mean, I knew he was like, had that really good status for being good business mind and everything, but I mean, I wasn't too interested in him. But after this whole case started, I've been pretty interested in following it pretty closely from the beginning, because right when he got arrested, you know, I was actually in a meeting with some important people from overseas. And at first, the reaction when hearing, you know, about the allegations against him, they're kind of like, so what exactly did he do wrong? Because, you know, the biggest one that they're talking about is that he's, and it depends on which side you take, like the Gon side or the Nissan side. But the biggest one that they're obviously, the biggest allegation against him is that he did not report income for a period of like 8 years or something, or a total of $80 million in the financial statements for Nissan. And then also that he's been using Nissan money for some of his own personal projects or things that the company had approved. The company that they created in the Netherlands that was supposed to be investing in like new businesses and stuff, but it was in fact just paying for all of his homes in France and Brazil and in Beirut and everything. And so they were saying he was misusing money. But again, it just depends on which side you take. Like, if you listen to Mr. Gon, obviously, then he says everybody knew about what he was doing. Nissan just did not want to get taken over, or did not want to cede too much control to France and to Renault. And of course, Nissan is just saying that, you know, he's a criminal and he's been doing all these wrong things and stuff. So,
why don't we first talk about what, because there's that theory, right? There's that theory of why he got arrested, what you just kind of broke into just now, that even though he got arrested for financial abuse or something, he denies all those charges though. And that's what he's kind of fled for, because he doesn't feel like he's getting a fair trial. Apparently there's the theory that Nissan don't want him in charge anymore because he was planning a takeover for Renault to take over, and Nissan didn't want that. So because of that, they brought up these charges to get him off or get him out. And that is one theory. And yeah, so that's kind of where it started from, why he was arrested. And yeah. then he's kind of been in and out of detention for the past year, I guess, about the past year. So he got set out on bail, maybe like four times or something, three or four times. But yeah, during those times, he wasn't allowed a lawyer during those interrogation processes. He wasn't allowed to see his wife. So I think he could only speak to his wife twice in those times. And the last time was on Christmas Eve, the last Christmas Eve, just before he escaped. So his reasoning for leaving Japan is that he didn't feel like he was getting like treated correctly or getting, you know, an appropriate trial. Well, because, you know, in Japan, the prosecution rate is 99%. So he was worried that he wouldn't get a fair trial. And that is the main reason why he left Japan. And I think it's probably the first time that someone who has been arrested and has been put under detention, it's the first time that someone's actually escaped, left Japan, and he's basically escaped justice or fled from justice in Japan.
Injustice. I mean, one of the reasons I've been kind of fascinated about this case from the beginning is because in all of the overseas media, Wall Street Journal, Business Insider, Washington Post, from the beginning, they've kind of been putting out all these stories about how it was very clear that Nissan was trying to avoid the complete merger with Renault. And there's been very, very detailed stories about this, about how Nissan was fully knowledgeable that these plans were being put into place under some pressure by the French government. Of course, the French government owns 15% of Renault. Renault owns, like, what, 43.5% or 43.4% of Nissan. But Nissan only owns 15% of Renault, and they don't have voting rights. So, I mean, everybody knows that Nissan... or that Renault has always had a lot more control of Nissan, and Nissan has not liked that. But again, that was all structured during the time when Nissan was being saved, basically, by Ghosn. And they had started working with the government, Nissan did, to try to avoid this all-out merger that Renault had been pushing for a long time. And Mr. Ghosn had normally played the role of kind of peacemaker between all the different parties. And when it was becoming clear that this was going to happen, then they started this investigation into different things about Mr. Ghosn, trying to find out some dirt on him. And they started finding out many different things that he had done wrong. But his whole take on the story is that everybody knew what he was doing wrong, or that he was doing the whole time. You know, this thing about his not reporting his compensation, that all started because in 2010 there was a new law that was passed in Japan saying that because of the financial crisis, that they wanted companies that were listed on the stock exchange to report the salaries of their top executives. And Mr. Ghosn at that point was worried about there was going to be backlash about his high salary, which actually wasn't very high in world standards, but definitely very high for Japanese standards. And he says actually it was Nissan who proposed that they start to set up the system of deferring a lot of his compensation until after retirement. But he's saying that nothing was actually ever signed on or decided for good. So there was actually no wrongdoing that was done there. The interesting thing is he's actually paid, Nissan and Carlos Ghosn have both paid fines to the Security and Exchange Commission, SEC, in the United States for these charges of underreporting his income or not properly reporting.
Paid fines, basically, for what he's done already.
Yeah, and they haven't really talked about, I mean, so basically Nissan and Carlos Ghosn and actually one other gentleman, Greg Kelly, they have all paid fines with the agreement that there would be no admitting or denying of the allegations. But Nissan paid $15 million for the civil penalty, Ghosn paid $1 million, and Kelly paid $100,000, and this was back in September last year. So it's basically like, I mean, they have admitted that they did this thing wrong, you know. But the criminal case in Japan, that has no bearing on the criminal case in Japan. So in the criminal case, he's still denying that he did anything wrong. But you got to say, like, well, then why did you pay the civil penalty to the SEC? So yeah. I don't know. That's kind of one strange part about it. But
well, I was mentioning how absurd the reaction that this case is getting, considering that Ghosn has only not really committed a huge crime, but I mean, for most people, especially the general public, no one's really been affected. So the only people that have really been affected are the shareholders and the stockholders, because it's the money from the company that is apparently he has been siphoning somewhere else, or he's been mislabeling as his compensation. But general public, yeah, he hasn't hurt anyone, he hasn't killed anyone, he's not a terrorist. So, which is, you know, if you compare it to the UK, in the UK, the only people that can be held without charge for 14 days is a terrorist in the UK. And even that is kind of controversial in Britain. And in Japan, I don't know, maybe we should go into what the justice system is like in Japan for when someone commits a crime.
Yeah, well, I mean, they call it a hostage justice system, kind of tongue-in-cheek, because there is this method where the authorities can just continue to rearrest a person and detain them for, what is it, 20 days, 21 days or something?
Hold them for 21 days, yeah.
Yeah, each time they're arrested. And this kept happening to Ghosn. He kept getting rearrested each time that period was coming to an end. And on top of that, you can be detained and interrogated for many hours on end during a day without a lawyer being present. So this is obviously not something that is same as the standards in other countries. The biggest thing, did you see this quote by the justice minister, or not quote, but a tweet that she sent out?
No.
Her name is Masako Mori, so Mori-chan. She sent out a tweet, I think it was like right after the he gave his press conference in Beirut, and she sent out this tweet saying that Mr. Ghosn should come to Japan to prove his innocence. And everyone was like, prove his innocence? Like, normally, you know, an innocent is a person is presumed innocent until proven guilty. But people say, yeah, in Japan, you're presumed guilty until proven innocent. And so she sent out this tweet that said that. And then she backtracked it on the next day. She deleted it as quickly as possible and tried to send out another tweet saying that he should come to Japan to assert his innocence, not prove his innocence. But everybody had already taken note of her tweet, and she took a lot of heat for that. But yeah, this whole the justice system in Japan, not only that, there's been a lot of things like the Rising Wasabi keeps putting out obviously a lot of great articles about this whole Ghosn situation, but they've put out a lot of examples of other executives in Japanese companies who have done just as bad as what's being brought up here, well, slightly different types of crimes. But for example, like the nuclear companies receiving bribes from local governments, or even recently Japan Post, some executives had to quit the company because Japan Post was selling insurance policies, like 13,000 insurance policies that were putting people in worse situation or even charging them double for insurance. And you want to talk about like abusing the public's trust. And the only thing that happened is like three executives of Japan Post had to resign, and they're not allowed to sell insurance for like 3 months or something. So, but nobody's being kept in jail for 100 days. Nobody's being interrogated on end without a lawyer present. You know, all these Japanese executives are not receiving the same treatment that Ghosn did. And even in Nissan themselves, like there weren't that many Japanese executives that were taking any heat for all this whole situation anyways. I think a few people have since been fired, but immediately it was just Ghosn and Greg Kelly, an American who is his, I guess, main assistant, but no Japanese executives or anyone is actually, you know, under any of the same type of abuse and trouble that Ghosn was. So
yeah, and apparently Kelly, Greg Kelly, he's basically taking all the heat from because he's still in Japan.
Yeah,
and he has to face up to everything now that Ghosn's kind of left him and, you know, by himself to defend for himself, which kind of sucks for him because now they're probably going to get even more strict on him now that Ghosn has fled. They're probably not going to be so lenient with bail for him because they'll probably think that he could flee too. And
I was gonna say like one thing I did notice on TV, because I was watching some Japanese TV as this whole thing was unfolding. And obviously, in Japanese media, they've been really bad-mouthing Mr. Ghosn. They've been he's been calling it like character assassination, basically. But and in fact, he didn't let any Japanese media in his or only a few representatives from Japanese media in his press conference because he felt like it wasn't.
Do you think that was a mistake? Like for him to do that, to not let the Japanese media in, because maybe he should have, you know, at least so he could share his side to the Japanese media.
Well, I think no one has heard his side, right? You know what I mean? Yeah, in a sense that way, I think it is. But I completely understand where he's coming from. Like he doesn't feel like they're gonna give him fair coverage anyways. Like why give them any ammunition to you know, do something wrong with it? But like on talk shows and stuff on TV, they'd have like lawyers on, and the first show I saw, actually this was before Ghosn gave his press conference, but like the first comment that was made is like they were asking this lawyer like, oh, what do you think about the whole Ghosn situation? He was like, oh, well, hell must have been very hot, basically meaning, you know, that's why Ghosn like took off from the country, you know.
Yeah.
Saying that he's in hell because, you know, he committed these crimes and stuff, and so everyone is still pretty much bad mouthing Ghosn. But the one thing they all are recognizing is that the Japanese legal system is getting a lot of attention for its unfairness and maybe some things that aren't up to standards of the United Nations like they're supposed to be. So,
yeah, so this is probably a good thing because it puts the justice system definitely under a spotlight now, and, you know, the international community are talking about it, whereas before, you know, no one was really talking about it. But now people realize how serious it is in Japan, and, you know, like the lack of human rights that, you know, suspects are entitled to. So like you're saying, the UN, what did they say? They said something, the Human Rights Committee has called on Japan to reform its current system. And there have been there was a petition in 2019 in April that 1,000 lawyers and scholars are demanding an end to this system. And these are Japanese lawyers and scholars too. So it's because, you know, it's like the system is only the prosecutors tend to have a lot of power. So even defense attorneys, they're not even allowed to see their clients when they've been detained or they're being scrutinized and what's the word? They're being
interrogated.
Yes. Yeah. So they're not allowed to have a lawyer present. So yeah, defense lawyers don't really have a chance because the conviction rate is so high, and prosecutors, they basically rule the justice system. So it's nice to see that hopefully something will get done about it. But apparently, because of Gon's case, do you remember the Mount Gox founder? Do you remember Mount Gox?
Cryptocurrency. Right.
So that founder, Mark Karpels, so he after the whole cryptocurrency, it was like the biggest crypto exchange in 2014, and it went bankrupt. And apparently, you know, people are saying he stole the money, or the money's missing, because there's still 650,000 Bitcoin that have never been found, and that case is kind of still ongoing. Yeah. And this Mark Karpels has basically denied, you know, all wrongdoing. So he was like fighting the courts, you know, and eventually he got found guilty and got a suspended sentence of 2.5 years. But before Gon left Japan, he was meeting with this Mark Karpels guy.
Oh, really?
Because they were trying to meet and they were trying to work together and, you know, to fix the system. So this Mark guy, he's really disappointed that Gon left, like fled the country, because now he doesn't have anything to kind of help him with, you know, fighting for justice, basically. That's what their plan was intentionally. So he didn't know that Gon was going to flee, and they were having meetings before, like when he was on bail, about how to kind of rectify the system, or, you know, solve some of the justice problems that was happening in Japan. And he sees it as like an opportunity lost. So he's really disappointed that Gon fled. And he think if he stayed, then he might have, with his status and those two together, maybe they would have a chance of making some kind of reform. But obviously Gon probably didn't believe that he had a chance.
Yeah, and well, that's what he was saying.
He was right.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of his biggest things, is he never felt like he was going to get a fair trial. They kept delaying his trial. They didn't have a start date, and the final straw was on Christmas Day or whatever, when he found out that they were going to delay the start date for the trial for his second charge. And so, like Gon is, he made it very dramatic and said he felt like he was just going to die in Japan waiting for this whole thing to get resolved. You know, let's just say how ridiculous it is, number one, that it's a 99.4% conviction rate. Like, something that is that perfect from the beginning, like, can you trust it?
Yeah,
you know, something that claims to be basically perfect. Nothing is that perfect. You know, that's suspect right there. Yeah, for sure.
And there've been other cases, you know, famous cases. There was one in 2014. Did you hear about this one? She was known as the vagina artist. So, did you hear about that?
It kind of rings a bell, but I don't remember anything. Yeah.
So this Japanese lady called Megumi Igarashi, and she was arrested or detained for 3 weeks for distributing obscene material, because what she did, she was an artist, and she made digital scans of her own genitals.
Oh, yeah, I did hear about that.
She would make them into, like, key fobs, and she made, like, a canoe. And then so she was canoeing down, like, rivers and stuff in this, you know, this canoe that was like, looked like her vagina, basically. So she got dubbed the vagina artist. And she was, she was detained for 3 weeks. And you know, if you did that in other countries, Western countries, you probably wouldn't get arrested for 3 weeks. Yeah, and then there was another guy in 2010, an MP, Tomohiro Ishikawa. So he was arrested for taking bribes, but he denied all his charges. So he was held for 3 weeks, and he said that every day he was interrogated for 12 hours without a lawyer, and he said they forced him to sign a confession, something that he never even said. So they'd already prepared this written document, and they were just saying, you have to sign this, you have to sign this. And they were basically like just trying to break him down. And some of the prosecutors were like crying and stuff, saying, oh, you have to sign this, you know. And yeah, and he just refused. But eventually he had to plead guilty of a more of a minor crime. But he ended up pleading guilty for something, just because otherwise they wouldn't have let him go.
Yeah, Gon was mentioning that, and we've had other people talk about that too. John was talking about that on the podcast that he came on. How safe is Japan really, or is Japan really safe?
Is Japan really that safe? Yeah,
really that safe. Yeah, where they basically prepare the confession for you, and as Gon was saying, they just kept telling him it's only going to get worse. It's only going to get worse unless you confess to this. And he's like, why would I confess? I don't believe I'm guilty. But they basically just try to coerce the people into confession. And I mean, is that what the purpose of an interrogation should be? I mean, that probably happens in all countries to a certain extent, but not without a lawyer present. It's not in this like 12 hours of interrogation, sometimes in the middle of the night or whatever, being put in solitary confinement just for some type of, you know, just to get a confession, no matter how small the crime may be, you know.
Right. Should we talk about his escape? Because his escape is like just so dramatic. It's like it could definitely be made into a Hollywood movie in the future. It's got,
yeah,
you know what I mean, it's got like James Cameron written all over it, I think.
For sure. I mean, go ahead. What did you want to say?
I heard the people that organized his escape, he'd been contacting them probably for about a year or so, or maybe half a year. And the leader of this team that helped him escape was an ex-US Army Green Beret. He was a Michael Halo Taylor. Jumper. Yeah. So that was his name. And he started his own private company. Like, what they do, they like rescue kidnappers or people that have been kidnapped. They protect executives in dangerous areas. He's worked with the DEA. He's worked undercover to investigate Lebanese drug traffickers. So he has a lot of experience, and he was the head honcho for the team that was planning to, you know, get gone out of Japan.
Yeah, he has a bit of a shady background himself. He's been convicted of some crimes. I think it was back in 2012 when his biggest case started. I think he's been connected to a few different crimes, but the biggest one was for bid rigging to earn contracts for something up to like $50 million in Afghanistan or something. So, but he said during that case, you know, he had been kind of held what he felt in a similar hostage justice situation in the Utah prison system, kind of waiting for things to actually get moving on his case, and it dragged on for like a year. So he was saying that he was sympathetic of Mr. Gon's situation, and he's also married to a Lebanese woman apparently too. So there might be some connection there as well. But yeah, he was the main guy in charge of this whole dramatic escape, which started, again, something just ridiculous because of how lax security was on Mr. Gon's house, or not security, but just surveillance. There was like only cameras at the entrance of his residence in Roppongi that he was renting while he was out on bail, which he was finally able to get for paying a total of like $14 million or something. But anyways, there was only one camera there, and they were only required to turn in the footage from that one camera once a month on the 15th of the next month. So like he was barely being surveyed, and he was free to travel domestically, which was another reason they said that he was able to get out. But yeah, what information do you have about his actual getting out? So what happened?
Yeah, so that, and then they chartered a plane. And on that, and then using their plane, they first kind of checked out which airports and how lax the security was, like how easy it was to get through customs and X-rays. So they ended up going through was it Kansai Airport?
Kansai International, but the kind of the private terminal for like private jets and stuff, not the main terminal where regular passengers go, but.
Right, and then they realized that going through X-ray, there were certain size boxes or certain size things that wouldn't get X-rayed. So, which is why they ended up putting Gone in these huge boxes that usually carry musical instruments for like rock bands, like amps and stuff like that. And so they put him in one of those. I read somewhere that they wrapped him up in some kind of, I don't know, like tape or something, so he wouldn't be able to get detected.
No, I don't know if
that might have been just somebody like a meme or something.
No, I think that was I think that was one of the satirical articles that got put out there.
Yeah, right.
But there has been some confusion about that whole music box thing, because some people were first reporting that this like fake band had gone to his residence in Roppongi to kind of give like a Christmas concert, and that he was smuggled out of the house in the music box, but he actually walked out the front door apparently, and what they're reporting the latest, because again, there wasn't much surveillance and he was able to do this, and he did this quite often. And they said that security did not follow him whenever he would go into a hotel. So he went into the Grand Hyatt in Tokyo, and from there was able to make it to Shinagawa Station, then took the bullet train to Osaka, where he met up with those gentlemen. I think there were two, Michael Taylor and somebody else. And then that's where the process started of getting him into the box and going through the security and everything.
Yeah. So I think getting to the airport, it wasn't very difficult. He was just wearing like a regular surgical face mask that most Japanese people wear. So I think if he was on any kind of public transport, no one would have noticed who he was anyway.
Yeah, and they said that he had actually traveled to Kyoto on the same bullet train before with his daughter on a trip that he was about to go on. So
I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess I probably would have noticed him if I saw him walking around, especially in Sapporo, I guess. But in Tokyo, maybe I wouldn't have noticed him. But if he was wearing a face mask, then yeah, definitely not.
But he said during his press conference, even when he would go out in the city, like people would see him all the time and everybody was still really friendly with him. I mean, he kind of used this during his press conference to kind of show that, that he still has really good feelings towards Japan, and that B, there's only a set few people who are actually going after him, which are the people in the government or people that were affiliated with Nissan. And he's trying to say like the general public, there were a lot of people that were supporting him, apologizing to him for the whole thing that he was going through.
Saying, so "Ganbatte kudasai," right?
So, I mean, he could have easily made that trip to Kansai maybe without too much trouble, even if he was noticed,
You were saying when you were back at home in America, like what was the media like reporting on it? Were they like kind of pro with what Gon did, or were they against what he did? Because it seems like the Japanese media is obviously, they're against him. They're like, oh, he's a terrible guy. He shouldn't have left. He shouldn't have fled. He should have stayed and defended himself. But I don't know what the media was like in America. Was it like sympathizing with...
Yeah, well, from the beginning, not just when I've been back in the U.S., but the international media, again, I've been kind of following this case closely, but, I mean, everyone is saying that, you know, if bringing up the word white-collar crime and everything, because if he is underreporting his income, but this whole thing with his income, these are things that executives do all the time, deferred payment until they retire, so it's nothing new. And using subsidiary companies to buy, properties or whatever, I mean, that's all questionable. Like, should you use shareholder money to do that? But people are kind of, the companies are buying residences or paying for residences for people all the time. So it's nothing strange,
It's like a common practice, even though it's not like legit in a way.
Yeah. So everybody, most media at that point, at the end of the year, has just been focusing on the fact that he made this dramatic escape and stuff. And I mean, everyone's kind of calling him the world's most famous fugitive and things like this. But I mean, I think there's internationally, there's actually more attention on how ridiculous his treatment was when he was in detention. And just the fact that Japan was going to get embarrassed by this whole thing to begin with. And again, from the beginning, they've been reporting that Nissan orchestrated this whole thing to avoid the complete merger with Renault. And so, I mean, I have seen people criticizing going for what he did. My mom's actually somebody who said like she couldn't stand seeing his face and stuff. So our people overseas that, you know, don't have good feelings about him.
So your mom thinks that he shouldn't have escaped. He should have stayed.
Yeah.
Like even though he was, you know, he committed a crime, but she thinks he shouldn't have fled.
Yeah, well, I mean, she thinks that he's a criminal, and so he should face the music. We kind of started to get a little bit of an argument about it, and my dad was like, I'm going to bed. I don't want to hear this. And then I was like, I think about it, I was like, man, why was I sitting there trying to go after my mom about this? But, I mean, you know, because we're on, like, family vacation and stuff. But, I mean, yeah, but maybe she's been actually reading more Japanese media as well, you know. Mm. But, I mean, for her, she just feels like somebody's guilty. They should obviously go through a trial. But his whole thing is he's willing to go through a trial. He just doesn't think he was going to get the fair trial in Japan. And now that's why he's saying he's willing to do it in Lebanon or anywhere else. But he's actually – that's another interesting thing. He's kind of in trouble in Lebanon as well. I mean, they're not going to extradite him at this point for anything related to this whole Nissan case. But, you know, as during his time as CEO of Renault, he traveled to Israel. And technically, Lebanon and Israel are at war. So it's actually a crime for Lebanese citizens to travel to Israel. And so there were some prosecutors in Lebanon that actually have brought a case against him, which comes with jail time if he's actually convicted for it. But other people are saying that that's just being brought up to kind of paint this picture that he shouldn't feel too safe in Lebanon, but apparently he does feel pretty safe there. But
yeah. I mean, that's where he was born, wasn't it? Like Lebanon, so that's his hometown where he grew up.
He's a bit of a hero there. They've put him on a stamp actually a couple years ago. But I mean, Lebanon has a lot of political problems and there's a lot of ill feeling towards the elite. And he's definitely considered some of the elite. So maybe in the general populace, he might not be that famous and supported. But I mean, he's definitely more supported than he is in Japan. So.
I recently found this article in the Japan Times talking about what general people in Japan feel about the case, and this was taken in March. So when he was released in March, gone, the TV Asahi took a poll and 54% agreed that it was necessary to keep him in prison for almost 4 months for his charges. And only 25% opposed it. So that they disagreed that he should have been detained for so long and convicted of no crime, which is quite low. But I don't know if you spoke to like any of your Japanese friends or coworkers about what they think about the case.
It comes up at work, and to be honest, nobody was ever really thinking like he did too much of anything wrong. I think just like Gon says, like I think most people realize how ridiculous it is. But I think in the end, Japanese people are probably going to support this whole like protecting one of their main and best brands, Nissan. I mean, that's what people keep saying in this whole thing. Nissan, the actual words Nissan means Japan industry. And Nissan's like one of the, well, used to be one of the most best performing Japanese brands out there. Obviously, Gon talked about this as well, but both Renault and Nissan,
partnership?
Partnership has suffered greatly. After, I mean, the stock of both companies has dropped like 30%. They're selling like both brands are selling like 500,000 cars less than they were.
Yeah, and you got Nissan, right? You got an X-Trail, haven't you?
Yeah, I was going to talk about that because when this whole thing started, I was thinking about selling it. I was very passionate about being on Team Gon, not because like I want to support a criminal or anything, but just because of how he was being treated, and I thought some of it had to do with. Yeah. Well, that, and I think, you know, some of it had to do with being a foreigner as well, you know. But I ended up deciding that I was going to keep it because I purchased it during the Gon era.
Nice car, man. I like it.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a good car for the winter, especially and stuff. What was I saying before that?
the consortium of Nissan and other Renault.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and he's been trying to say that the reason that it's suffering, I mean, he's trying to say, you know, now that he's out of the picture, they're doing a lot worse than they were. He had another great quote, they missed the unmissable in trying to form to bring fiat into their alliance. But actually, a lot of their problems, financially and performance problems, started while he was still in his position, especially in the U.S., and some of it said that it had to do actually with his approach to business and stuff. So, but anyways, yeah, the performance has gone down. But nonetheless, I think people want to, in Japan, they want to protect Nissan as one of their own brands. And I can understand that, you know, like that happens in any country. Those countries want to protect their strongest companies. But I'll tell you this, man, just to like to sacrifice just the health of the company just to avoid like having to get too close or work too close with an overseas brand. Like this situation.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy. It's like, the measures they take just to keep that, I don't know, almost like their reputation or something. They just want to keep it close to home, you know, instead of improving it, making it better.
Yeah.
Which seems quite a Japanese thing to do.
Yeah, like self-sacrifice, basically, like
big time.
I mean, you know, they're cutting like 12,000 jobs or more. So, like, because of how bad things are getting, and I mean, is this all like, was it worth it? You know, was it not worth it? I think those are some of the questions. But I'm especially looking forward to what's going to happen going forward because I think, you know, building up to his press conference, a lot of people were looking forward to him talk about A, his escape, and B, like name these names of government officials who were tied into this whole like, you know, scheme to oust him from power. And in the end, he didn't actually give up any names because he was saying that, you know, that because of the relationship between Lebanon and Japan, he didn't want to create undue stress for Lebanon by naming these names of Japanese government officials. But to be honest, I think it has something to do with his whole plan of that he's plotting to actually go after some of these people in a bigger way. He's already filed a suit against Nissan in Europe for like 50 million euro for the way he was ousted from his position as CEO of Renault. But I think he's got some other big things that he's working on to go out after some of these government officials, and he just kind of wants those people to wonder if they're on his hit list or not, you know, and put him in a little bit of fear or something. Yeah. So,
did you watch the news conference?
I did. I stayed up and watched it, and I mean, I was disappointed. He didn't actually, in my opinion, bring up anything new, and some of the he tried to like. Did you watch it?
No, I heard about it though, and one person, he's a former economic advisor for Shinzo Abe. He just says Ghosn's talk was boring. That's what he said in a tweet about a news conference.
Well, the thing is, he's actually like really, you know, he's a great presenter, and that's what he was kind of known for. I mean, he's very much into himself. So it was actually kind of pretty theatrical and interesting to watch. But, I mean, there was a lot of weak points to it. Like, he kept trying to put up these, like, documents to show, like, how he was innocent and some of these allegations against him. But, like, nobody could read what was actually being put up because of the way that they were being projected onto the wall.
Oh, right.
And he said he was going to eventually make all this paperwork available to people. I don't know if he's actually done that yet. And, again, he didn't do what a lot of people were thinking he may do, which was name some of these names of these Japanese government officials and stuff. So, but it was still interesting. It was interesting for him to finally get his chance to be dramatic about his feelings on being mistreated and everything. But I mean, yeah, it's kind of right now at a situation where it's like, what's going to happen next? Is he actually going to go after? And he's still saying like, you know, he's willing to go on trial in Lebanon again or anywhere else, just as long as he feels like he can get a fair trial. But
the case has pretty much been dropped, right, in Japan. Like, he's not going to face charges or his charges have been dropped because he's not going to come back.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they've officially dropped them against him yet, but yeah, unless they can extradite him, then last week I think half of his legal team or something quit the case because they basically see that like nothing's going to move forward, and just like you said, Greg Kelly is going to face charges or his portion of the charges for everything that's come up, and they did fire some of these Japanese executives that they say have been similarly not properly reporting their income, but in their case, it was only like hundreds of thousands of dollars. They've all said that they've got to return the money and they're going to, I think that a lot of them have been fired as well. But so yeah, the case in itself might actually go nowhere now, but I think this whole scrutiny of the Japanese justice system and everything is going to continue.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to see what happens with that, and hopefully there'll be some changes and some reforms in the near future, because it just seems like everyone is, I mean, I guess the thing about the justice system is everyone is terrified of committing a crime, which I guess is a good thing, because, you know, I remember hearing of one time this, I'm not sure if we spoke about it a while ago, but there was one guy in Sapporo, and he was like a salary man, and he was out one night in Suskino, and then he got into kind of a bit of a scuffle with a bunch of these kids, like young kids, and basically he let them, you know, beat him up. Like, he didn't fight back, because he knew if he fought back, he might be charged with some kind of assault or something, and then he would like get arrested, probably lose his job, because once you get arrested and you get detained, you probably will lose your job, because you can't go to work for probably 3 weeks or something. And so, yeah, so he decided that he would rather get beaten up, you know, because of that, because he was so afraid to be arrested, he'd just rather get the crap kicked out of him by a bunch of kids instead of defend himself.
Yeah, I guess in that sense, if the justice system is deterring people from committing crimes and is serving its purpose, but again, like, once people are arrested, they should have a certain level of rights as a suspect. And, you know, maybe in a lot of these cases, when people are innocent, actually, and they're just completely being mistreated, or, you know, going through all this interrogation that isn't considered, you know, up to standards internationally, then, you know, people shouldn't be subjected to that. So hopefully there will be some reforms in that way going forward.
Yeah, for sure. Anyway, I think we've spoke for quite a long time, actually.
Yeah, longer than I thought we would be able to be honest. This has been pretty good, man. Hopefully this, because again, I think the quality is good, so I hope it turns out well for people. We'll be giving more details about how they can check this out on YouTube.
Yeah, and then, yeah, we've got a YouTube page. We've had a YouTube page for a while, but we haven't actually posted any videos yet. This is going to be our first one, and the first of many, hopefully. Hopefully we'll be able to keep doing this through, I don't know, some other video means, some other media, but we're definitely going to keep posting regular videos of our discussions and interviews onto YouTube. So, yeah, keep in touch, everyone. And if you want to support the podcast, you can click on the donation link, as always, in the description. And also, another way, if you want to support us, you can, you know, leave us a review on iTunes, especially iTunes or Apple Podcasts, because if you leave a review and a rating, 5-star rating hopefully, you know, it helps people who are unsure if they're going to listen to the podcast. They can read a review and it will, you know, help them to decide. And also, it probably bumps up our podcast in the rankings, having good reviews, and then more people can find us. So that's a good way of supporting us too, and that'll really help us out.
Yeah, please do, everyone. We definitely appreciate it.
All right, see everyone. Catch you next time. And catch you next time as well, Burke.
Yeah, you too, man. I'm looking forward to doing another recording together in the same location.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Take it easy.
All right, man. See you
next time.